Welcome to a new episode of Metal Minds, the Pit Unplugged, the podcast from Metal.de. My name is Diana Heinbucher and I will guide you through today's pit. Today it's about a project that deliberately eludes the usual categories, The Moth, a work that has been worked on over a decade, supported by a large number of musicians, orchestra, choir, and a numerous creative network. Today, my guest is an artist who stands for crossing boundaries like no other in metal, between genres, between concepts, between control and chaos, Devin Townsend. We talk to him about The Moth as a possible life's work, about art as a space for reflection, and about the question, what happens when music becomes so big that it is no longer just wants to be heard, but penetrated. Devin, nice to have you here.
It's a pleasure to talk to you, and thank you for that lovely introduction.
In a few days, The Moth will be released, a work you've been working on for good 10 years. How do you feel about it?
I feel similar, although the scale of this project was bigger than any project that I've done. My intent behind making records is the same, whether or not it's a big project or a small project. And when there's been a project like The Moth that's been ongoing and there's been so many logistical challenges with it, now that it's done, I feel profound relief. You know, it's less about pride or less about anything like that. I'm just like, oh, okay, thank God, right? Now we can move forward.
Okay. And I've had the honor to listen to The Moth, and I would like to deliberately call it a work, not an album, because when you listen to it, it becomes clear that it is much more than an album. It is an epochal work of art that serves so many different levels. You said this project is your life work. Why isn't this work just an album?
Yeah, it's my other life. I'm okay. Not the other life. It was a life's work up to a certain point, and then it's like it summarized that particular period. It's almost like there's a before and an after this project for me conceptually. So it's life's work, but a life that is no longer there. If that makes any sense at all, which I don't know if it does, but that's how I feel.
Yeah, I think it makes sense because we are moving on and we are transformed through different life stages. And so I think it makes sense to say another life that's not longer there.
Well, what's interesting about it as well is that when I first started the project, you know, the idea of a metaphor for a moth is pretty basic. It's, you know, transformation from one form to another, or even a creature that's so drawn to the light that it destroys itself, or any of these metaphors are pretty straight up. But the ways that it ended up coming together for me, and unexpectedly so, was that what was destroyed as a result of that transformation were, in some ways, stories that I had told myself about myself that were untrue. Mm-hmm. But I think you just neurologically fall into patterns. Like the more things happen, the more trauma, the more social situations that echo similar scenarios occur, you can be forgiven for just thinking, oh, well, that's how I am. This is who I am. This is what my process is, you know, and you sort of rigidly adhere to these identities. But through the process of this record that included, unfortunately, but also fortunately, a lot of personal change, I was forced into a scenario, I think, creatively to recognize that what gets burnt up was no longer serving me anyway. So the metaphor ended up changing, I guess, by the end.
I can, I understand you. I cope, we all cope with different struggles, with problems. And sometimes in a situation, we start to accept things other people said about us. And that's not true, that not we. And you said it, we start to believe things we are not. that we are not are. And it's hard to break the cycle, to come back to ourselves.
Well, it's almost, I would say it's sometimes it feels impossible. And I don't know if my capacity as a human being would have been proactively able to pursue that sort of change. I lost a bunch of friends and, you know, ends of long-term relationships and kids moving out and all these circumstances that I think emotionally up to that point, I've been very stoic about it. I either, you know, you intellectualize your emotions or you try to analyze them in a way that allows you to have some sort of control over them, perhaps. But I found during this period that there's some scenarios that are beyond at least my capacity to intellectualize. I just was like, I felt broken, right? And in those moments, I feel that's when the truth of these things start revealing themselves, when you no longer have the strength to tell yourself lies about yourself. You know, like, I'm the type of person that does this. I'm the type of person that reacts like this. I always do this. But in those moments, I was just like, man, I can't think like that. I just have to sit with this and participate with the pain in a way that was cathartic. I think that, you know, my fear of feeling things, my fear of pain, my fear of anger, my fear of, you know, interpersonal dynamic, whatever it is, to have that, to be thrust into a scenario where I can't rationalize it any other way other than just being like, okay, I feel this. This is like a real thing. And in those moments, a lot of the truth about who I feel like I am revealed itself to me. And it was surprising too, because I think some of the stories that I'd told myself in the past was like, any negativity that's in me, whether or not it's anger or fear or hatred or any of these things, are emotions that need to be suppressed. And this is, you know, things that I was taught from a very young age, like, these are unhealthy emotions. These are inappropriate reactions. But to all of a sudden find myself in a position where I can't, you know, rationalize any thoughts other than whatever I'm feeling, I started recognizing, I'm like, well, I'm actually not that type of person. I'm actually not as peaceful as I thought. I'm not as centered as I thought I was or told myself I was. I'm none of these things. I recognize, I guess, that a lot of that anger and fear and trauma and all these things that I had been suppressing were really a product of trauma and a product of trying to take a part of me and say, you have no voice. The process of being thrust into a scenario where I felt I needed to acknowledge that at least led to an unexpected reaction, which I think was a type of self-compassion that had been missing. So it's almost like it's okay to feel those things. You don't necessarily have to express it. There's appropriate and inappropriate ways to express any of those emotions. But to tell yourself that it doesn't exist or that it can't have a voice is almost like denying half of my nature, and finding that sense of compassion for a part of me that I've tried to keep quiet for so long yielded a whole new way of viewing myself, my artistic process, and my life in general. And I think that's why, going back to our first question, I view it as being, yes, it's a life work, but it's a life that doesn't exist anymore. You know what I mean?
Mm. I think to go this way, you need to be very brave or naive. I want to say brave.
I'd like to say brave too, but I think that the quote that I always kept going back to, I even put it in the bio, was just like, bravery is not an absence of fear. It's being terrified, yeah. but still doing it, you know?
Yeah. And you talked about that you so many things let go, that you question yourself again and again. And you had the vision about the moth for over 10 years. And how does the process of finding yourself, I will call it in this way, has an influence on the project?
I think it's, again, unexpected. I perhaps because of the way that I had sort of structured my way of creating or thinking or performing or being, there were certain thoughts of how something like this would come together, but frankly, none of those transpired. It was just always like, oh wow, I didn't expect that. Oh wow, I didn't expect that. So when this 10 years is being cited as like the gestation period for the moth, the first five of those 10 years was me just trying to figure out how to do it. Mm-hmm. So I started taking lessons for orchestration. I didn't know music theory. And I feel that maybe arrogantly I had hung on to that like it was romantic. Like, hey, man, I don't even know what I'm doing, which is only romantic until you're paying for an orchestra by the hour. And then all of a sudden I'm like, wow, I need to figure this out because the only person that's like suffering from my ignorance is me, right? So I began to take orchestration lessons and start to figure out really rudimentary things that was frustrating because, you know, after 30 records or whatever, I have processes that are very efficient and I can kind of move through that very well, but none of those things applied. So when I was taking the lessons, it went from having these reasonably complicated ideas come out without having any need to be technically savvy, be challenged. And then, you know, the person that I was working with is like, I need you to do Mary Had a Little Lamb and then figure out what a harmony would be for the viola, what a harmony would be for the celli, where's the range for the tenors versus the baritone. And I felt so frustrated because it's like I knew how to run and then all of a sudden I'm being told, rightfully so, that I can't even crawl properly. So the first 5 years went into a combination of learning the technical things that go into this sort of expression, but also team building. What I recognized very quickly in the process is to do something with this scale. By the end of it, you know, hundreds of people were involved with this process. The skill set was much less about the artistic vision and much more about how do you navigate these interpersonal scenarios, whether or not it's conflict resolution or trying to instill some sense of morale, or in our case, every step of the way with the moth, we had to figure out solutions. If we had, unending capital, I would have flown to each one of the teams, right? So we had recording sessions going on in India, Thailand, China, Canada, UK, Spain, Australia. You know, there's just all over the world, we had these teams. Like we had a small choir here, we had a small ensemble here, we had a singer here, we had, you know, whatever the case may be. And again, if we had all the money in the world, we'd just fly there and be like, okay, so this is how it goes and let's work out the parameters of it. But not having that, very quickly, we had to learn to delegate. And at that point, I was like, okay, so how do we do that? Okay, well, we'll have a head of a team here. 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 And then my vision for whatever the music is needs to be only explained to the head of that team and then have them then try to go through and realize that independent of me. And I'm just watching it on Zoom, or we're watching the session on Zoom. And very quickly, you realize that to do that, the pitfalls of that became obvious really quickly. And one of which is like, you have to be super articulate with the head of the team. For example, we had a choir in the UK that we were tracking. And I talked to the guy who was putting it together, Tom, who was brilliant. And I thought I had I thought I had covered all the bases of what I was trying to do dynamically. Yet when the Zoom started and they're tracking, we've only got 2 hours to record this. We've only got the budget for 2 hours of recording. So you can't really stop it and say, actually, it's like this, or it's like this, or dynamically like this, or that. No, it's a little this and that and the other thing. And so there was a bunch of mistakes on this first one. And then I was thinking, okay, great. So next time that we do a session like this, you have to have a checklist of all of things: dynamics, note choice, enunciation, recording, DAW, any whatever it was. And then from there, the delegation started to become a little easier. But long story, incredibly long, I apologize. Much of that 10 years was spent just trying to figure out logistics of how we were going to pull it off.
Yeah, and communication, I think, when so many people were involved.
Totally, because you hear these stories in the 80s or the 90s where there was a real music industry, and then you had characters that maybe had a vision. And I certainly don't compare myself to any of these people, but just for the sake of this conversation, say someone like Prince. But, you know, the guy's fabulously wealthy, so he can maybe rationalize. It's like, don't look me in the eye. You know what I mean? Like, oh, this is wrong, I'm leaving or whatever. But man, doing mid-tier prog metal, you know what I mean? With limited capital means that if you throw a tantrum about something and you leave, just nobody comes back. So learning to communicate also included for me, like, how do I articulate the extent of something that is rooted in heavy emotions, yet not let those emotions dictate the interactions with these team members? And I guess the solution for that was that you just kind of have to split your connection to the process into two ways, like left brain, right brain, essentially. And when one takes pole position, the other one has to take a back seat. So when it was time to work on, communicating with people, or interpersonal scenarios where maybe one team member is in conflict with another, and then you have to try and find a resolution so that you can still make your deadline, the creative side has to take a back seat. You're just like, okay, you just sit there for a while. We're gonna let Lefty go into this or whatever. And then when we did have the opportunity again to get back into the vision or the emotional components or any of those things, then the right brain can step back. I don't know how that works, right or left, one of the two, but you get the idea. And then there's another thing that we found is there's this shocking transition that happens between those two types of thinking, where sometimes for a day, maybe sometimes an hour, you're just in this sort of nebulous zone where you're like, wow, I'm nowhere. I'm neither creative nor logistic. I just want to go to sleep, right? But these are examples of things that we didn't factor into the process that now we know the next one won't take 10 years.
Okay. You said that the way or the first 5 years were not easy, but how you hold your motivation is over a so long time that high that you don't stop?
Friends and family. You know, I feel that if there's any indicator that the direction that I'm headed creatively is that of something that I can stand behind, it's the quality of the people that are in my life. I have amazing people in my life. I have empathetic people in my life. I have creative people in my life. I have people that when we argue, when we find conflict with each other, we can find resolutions. And during those moments where I felt at my lowest, to have that type of support is immeasurable to me. And in fact, I was thinking this morning how difficult it would be for an independent artist to not have that sort of support network. And part of that support network also comes down to things are not always rosy. Sometimes you're just really depressed, or you're irritable, or any of these things. And other team members, same thing. They're depressed or they're irritable. But when you're able to support each other through those moments, it's like your reason for continuing has a lot to do with the fact it's like, well, I'm on a team. And in order to be on a team and to know where my skill set lies within that team, it's my responsibility to pull myself out of this. And I couldn't have done it without the team.
Yeah. And you said it, it's a team. You described it before that you have different teams with heads. So it's more like you had the last years to run a company.
Yeah. Well, that's it. And it's funny because you don't recognize it at the time when you're being creative, because I think when we're kids, you start playing instruments or you start painting or making films or whatever your artistic slant is, you're just so absorbed with the joy of creation that you think, oh, this is what it's going to be like always. And in fact, if it ever becomes even moderately successful, I'll just be able to be creative all the time. But what we're not told is to be a professional musician means that you spend 5% of your time making music. And the other 95% of the time is like logistics, whether or not it's Patreon or internet or interviews or file management or a conflict resolution or fixing your keyboard or any of these things. So when you finally get a chance to be creative, you're just like, all right, oh, I love this. And the only problem with that, though, sometimes is you're like, oh, I love this, but I'm exhausted now. So when I finally sit down to write, I'm just like, no, I'm just going to go watch TV and go to bed, right?
So you are very conditioned, or also when you said if you have then time to be creative, you're tired.
Yeah. but also I think another unexpected attribute of being a professional musician with this genre, at least, is you have to be a fighter.
Yeah.
You know, you have to fight for your creativity. And I'm not talking about like in a public sphere or with a label or none of that. I just internally. I think that one of the pitfalls of interests being of a philosophical nature, existential nature, is that you're always flirting with nihilism. It's like you can rationalize, like, oh, this is my intent, this is my reason, this is what the vision is. And if you're not careful, all those lead to, why are we doing this? Like, this doesn't make any sense. Like, is this just because I'm so insecure that I need to have these creative ideas validated by strangers in order to feel some sort of self-worth? Because if that's the case, oh my God, that's like miserable. So it's like this, the fight is kind of keeping a leash on your mind and keeping a leash on your emotions. But that leash also includes moments where you plan to let it off the leash. Like, for this day, there are no parameters. I can be as unhinged or as creatively free or whatever as I feel without any consideration to other people or the outcome of it, because I've learned, fortunately, that just because you write it doesn't mean you have to release it. Just because you think it doesn't mean you have to say it. And I think that the structures that go into facilitating those moments also go hand in hand with what the concept of the moth was. It's like, how many of those structures still apply? How many of these structures still serve you? So there's this undercurrent of existential like dilemma that goes through it all, that again, you kind of have to compartmentalize. You're like, you know, these thoughts will come up and you'll be like, okay, so right now we're just trying to figure out how to fix the keyboard. So let's put that at bay for a while. We'll deal with that one later. And it's a skill. I think that these are the things that you recognize. And where that skill is in opposition to creative freedom is at what point do those compromises that you have to make to be on a team interfere with your intent? And I think, again, that's a skill set, because you're like, okay, so what is a deal breaker within this? And the solution to that we have found is you set parameters that are fairly broad. So you can say, okay, so I'm fortunate enough to work with, let's just use an example, like a fantastic guitar player. Let's use that as an example. And you want to be able to incorporate into your work the things that make them fantastic, as opposed to saying, you're a tool and I want to use your skill set to do exactly what I want. I've been in that scenario and I hate it, right? So instead of that, we're like, okay, here's where it's going to be out of bounds. Here's where it's going to be out of bounds. Past that point, have fun. And then from there, you can find there's creative potential that you wouldn't expect while not compromising the vision, right?
If you think about the creative process, and if you think about the moth is maybe also the dark side of a butterfly, not only a sign of transformation,
really?
It's also a sign of self-destruction, I think. And if you think about the process of art, then we always think about create something, but I think in the process of being creative, there's also something that is destructive.
I think it can come down to perspective, though, I would say, as devil's advocate. And what I mean by that is, when I was first working on the moth, yes, all those things about a moth were confusing to me, because I'm like, yeah, it is kind of like a harbinger, and it's dark, and it's like, sort of, you know, it's at night and all this, and what does that mean about my creative impulse? Am I like trying to? But where it comes down to perspective is, you know, when we're being told constantly, you know, we have to be present. We have to be in the moment. And if you look at it from that point of view, the moment is constantly being destroyed. Like, in order to stay present, everything has to be destroyed constantly. Like, not everything, obviously, but your adherence to anything. You know, if you don't accept the fact that the only consistent part of this experience is change, then you're going to feel like it's constantly death. You know, everything's changing. Everybody's going. It's all different. Kids are moving out. Relationships are changing. It's like death, death, death after death, pain, pain, pain. But you see, if you flip, just a hypothesis, if you flip the script on that on some level, it's like, no, it's not. You're not focusing on the death of it. You're focusing on the presence of it. Does the death of something that isn't included in that present signify darkness, or does it signify something other? And in my impression, it signifies something other, because the focus is on the present as opposed to the death of the past, right? The metaphor with the moth also, at one point in the process, the idea had been thrown about that when the character like dies, the protagonist in the moth, it's revealed that he was a butterfly all along, you know, dun, 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 dun. But ultimately, I think any of these kind of spins on that theme implied a sense of like us knowing what life is about, which is so far from the truth that we had to try and avoid that at every turn. Anytime there was like, oh, we should have a moral. Oh, there should be an ending that says, and that's why, or anything like this. That's when we start thinking, you know, this is where it becomes problematic. Because if you make any statements about understanding the nature of the universe, I mean, just the hubris of that is like shocking. So, you know, we just had to make sure that we were focused on the positivity of, for example, the present versus the negativity of the present is constantly changing.
Mm-hmm. It's important because you describe it depends on the point of view. And sometimes, maybe I can only speak from my side. We sometimes caught in this negative world because the news, social media, all the things are focused on the negative and not on the positive things, like that everything what positive is what happens and that could make us happy is not worthy to speak about, but it's the other way around.
Totally. I think that's perpetuated by what we are being fed constantly, just media in general. I don't necessarily subscribe to the conscious malevolence of it all. I just think humans are stupid and we just find whatever makes money and we're just like, oh, that'll work. If negativity is what it takes, then I guess everything's negative. And then this silly species of apes looks around and goes, why is everything shitty now? You know what I mean? It's like, but I think what's also problematic is when we're told that all you have to do is think positive to solve it. It's such bullshit. It's like Hallmark card stuff. If you've got real problems, if you've got a chemical imbalance that is like, you know, diagnosed as like medical depression, no amount of thinking positive is going to help you. There's like the proactive sides of mental health, whether or not that's exercise, diet, nutrition, meditation. The proactive side of it is where the fight is. Because I think in order to foster an environment internally or externally of positivity in your life, it's not a passive, exercise. It's not gentle work. So I think when we are looking at the negativity of what surrounds us in the world, it's really important to have compassion for ourselves and to not say, what's wrong with me? How come I can't find positivity? What's wrong with me? How come I can't get out of bed? What's wrong with me? You know what I mean? It's like, what's wrong with you is that you're struggling. You know, it's an inevitable consequence in many ways to the world that we're living in right now. Specifically, if you have a job, if you're a human being in 2026 with a job, there's a good chance you got a phone. And if you've got a phone, there's a good chance that the spam even that's coming through on the emails that you've got to check for your job is going to be like, did you see the shitty thing that happened? You know, so you can't really stick your head in the sand and just like avoid these things just based on the ubiquitous nature of how it's everywhere. So having some degree of compassion for our reactions to that, self-compassion for the reaction to that, and be like, I'm struggling. This sucks. This isn't easy. I think is a good step, because then it's at least acknowledging it as opposed to chastising ourselves for not being strong enough to deal with it. You know what I mean? Some things are beyond our capacity. And this is why the proactive nature of like either mental health, physical health, family, friends, getting out there, getting out of bed. These are the things that I think are where the fight lies, you know?
Yeah. I think it's the thing with self-acceptance. It's quite hard because you said it earlier, or there are emotions where we told we are socialized in the way that there are the emotions we don't need to show, we need to suppress.
Totally. And also, I think, you know, what I found about myself is that the narrative that I had woven for myself, like the type of person that Devin is, was actually not true. It was like a idealized version of what I wanted people to think of me as, like, oh, I'm the type of person that doesn't do this, or I'm the person that does this, and I'm a peaceful, whatever. And then when my reactions, my authentic primal human reactions were not in line with that, I was just like, what the fuck's wrong with me? There's problems with me. But then through those problems, I was like, oh, it's because you were never that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like, all these things that you've been beating yourself up about not coming to the table to be, you were never that. You just, it was like a story that you told yourself about yourself. And then when I was able to be like, oh, actually, that's not what I am. I'm this. And it may not be as romantic. It may not be as like socially acceptable to be like, oh, actually, I do feel this way. Or actually, I am like this. Or actually, I do react like this. A lot of times, you know, when people are sometimes in my experience, when I've been looking for, you know, solutions to any of these problems, you know, you run across a lot of this kind of self-help stuff on the internet, or gurus or spiritual teachers or any of these things. And a lot of the times I'm just like, why don't I believe this? You know what I mean? I'm like, why does this ring so false to me? And I think a lot of it, for me at least, and I'm not saying across the board, I'm sure there's people that are profoundly centered, et cetera. But when you see inconsistencies in someone's narrative, you know, like someone's just like, well, you have to be in the moment and you have to go where you're going in order to be where you've been. And, you know, I got beads and shit. I'm just kind of like, yeah, but you seem fucked up in that way, you know, this other way. And so it's hard for me to accept what you're saying. It's like, you know, what was I was at a retreat recently, and I remember being introduced to this one organization, and they're just like, oh, it's all about peace and it's about love. And at the end of it, though, it was just like, there seems to be like such corruption. And I'm thinking, those two things don't make sense to me. Like, they don't play ball together. I can't quantify that. And so when we at least reverse that mirror on ourselves, it's the same thing. I'm like, well, the reason why I feel like I'm confused by myself is because I'm trying to adhere to a version of myself that's bullshit. You know, I'm not that guy. I'm actually this guy. And the best way to have that tested is when it's not in a vacuum. And by that, I mean, you know, when you're in a perfectly peaceful environment, it's really easy to tell everybody that you're a peaceful person. You know, because it's not being tested. But when I really found out how like not peaceful I was is when all of a sudden my life got crazy and I was like, oh, wow. Okay. I got work to do. Right.
Yeah. There are all the lies about ourselves. And sometimes for me, I'm a very high sensitive person, and I'm very shy for social contacts.
Yeah.
Because sometimes it doesn't fit. There's a misfit between the people, how they show up and how they are inside. And
well, and all, I'm sorry, yeah, go on.
And this discrepancy, the people don't feel self, but I've had this discrepancy by showing when the people show up. It's quite hard.
Totally. 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 And also it's exhausting. Just, I got friends of mine, it was my birthday the other day, and I find birthdays really difficult, right?
Yeah.
I had these friends that kept calling me because they wanted to talk. And I'm like, man, I love you so much, but I can't right now because the energy that it's going to take for me to pretend like I'm not in a fucked up frame of mind, is like, it's exhausting. And when it comes to social things, even the people that I care for the most, it's almost like I feel like if I go to a social thing, even one I love, I need the exact same amount of time to recuperate from it that I do. You know what I mean? So, well, maybe even more. If I'm at a party for an hour, I need 3 hours to kind of get over it, right?
Yeah. When we listen to The Moth, I think all the different faces and the different, how can I say it, the colors, the different colors you describe about the process, I think we hear it in this 24 tracks. And is there a song on this record that is partly close to your heart because it was easy to address or very difficult to write like this way?
I mean, it was all difficult. I mean, there's that. But I think the nature of of the moth and the trajectory through it was a very specific color to me. It was meant to be ugly, and it's meant to be like an audio movie, like a cinema to listen to. So it's not songs necessarily. It's cut into 24 pieces just because that's kind of part of what the narrative is. But it's supposed to be an immersive thing that's not song-based as much as just like an experience, right? That being said, we conscientiously made it very ugly. And the reason for that is the ending of The Moth, which is an ambient piece of music, is supposed to be juxtaposed by the huge amount of shit in the first part of it. Like hundreds of people, orchestras, like violence, sex, ugliness, you know, all these things had to be so over the top for the first part that at the end, when it's just ambient, it's hopefully meant to represent how our fear and how my fear compels me to try to make sense out of something that I'm just not capable of. I can't make sense out of the world. I mean, I can't make sense out of the universe. I don't know the meaning of life. It's like, so the quest to try and, embody that needs to be absurd. It has to be so gross because it's like, it's about people that don't understand trying to make sense of it. And then by the end, when it goes to the ambient stuff, the whole intent is just like, oh yeah, so surrender. And as a result, the parts in The Moth that were the most close to me and concurrently the most difficult, it was all equal. I don't think there was a standout on the record that was more connected to my emotional vision or more difficult. The whole first bit of it is all cut from the same cloth. The parts that are most close to my heart are the ambient stuff. We Don't Deserve Dogs, the last piece, is probably the closest to my heart. But honestly, even closer than The Moth is my Dream Piece project. So, but it's just ambient music, right? So I finished a record right as soon as The Moth was done that I'm releasing independently after, which is a continuation of We Don't Deserve Dogs. And it's just ambient music. And that's the music that's closest to my heart, just because it's a constant flow of something that I find beautiful, right? And that's much more important to me than 500 people making chaos, right? It's, but both play into this particular theme. So sorry, that was a difficult question to answer for me.
Oh, no problem. Because it fits to this, what I feel when I listen to The Moth, because for me, it's a work like an opera in a more wide way. And the songs depend on each other, and there is the chaos between these songs. It all makes sense. If you think about the record from the transition perspective, in my way.
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally. 100%. Thank you for the recognition of that. And also, what was interesting that came up over the past couple of weeks with the interviews is some people are just like, man, this is crazy music. It's crazy. And I'm thinking, I don't know what your last 2 years was like.
Yeah.
But it's like, for me, what the input of my life is going to determine the output. And this has been one of the most surreal, chaotic, disjointed, ugly periods of human history in some ways. Not every way, but in some ways. So if that's at least a substantial part of the input, the output is going to be that too. And I really look forward to the time when the input of my life yield something that isn't chaotic, you know?
Yeah.
But as a creative person, I guess, and a sensitive person, there's no way I cannot write what I feel. anytime I've tried to, it doesn't work. It just ends up being disingenuous. And regrettably, the world has just been really, really struggling over the past couple of years. And that's been my inspiration, I guess.
Yeah. Sometimes I say that an album is...
It's like an essay. It's like at the end of a year, it's like, like, what did I do in summer camp this year? You know what I mean? It's like, oh, I played with the trampoline. Oh, I had a fight with the counselor or whatever.
Yes,
and those are two tracks.
Exactly. Right? And album covers what you did the last year or what was up in the last 2 years. And so
2 years.
The moth is about 10 years and it's the essence.
Well, this is the thing. And I think that what I struggled with in the beginning of the moth was, do I allow the creative vision to follow how chaotic things have been in my life? And I had to deliberate about that because at first I was like, well, what good will that do for me just to put out a bunch of chaotic music and just compound people's craziness with more craziness? It's like, so I deliberated about it in the beginning, but then by the end I was like, well, the point of any moment for me creatively is to find some sort of resolution within myself. And if it has been as chaotic as it clearly has been, then it's only honest to represent that. But where the project changed halfway through is the original ending for the moth was also chaotic. It was also very sarcastic and whatever. And I realized very quickly that it's like, no, I don't want to invest the energy into something that's this big, logistically, just to make some sort of statement that makes shit worse for people. You know, it's like, if the original ending of the moth is like, don't try, fuck it, it's all fucked. You know, it's like, it's like, that's a lot of work to do. I'd rather just kind of go to the park or something, So instead of that, it was like, okay, so we fight for an ending. We fight for a resolution. We fight for something within ourselves that isn't easy, which isn't just like giving up into the chaos of it all. It's about saying, no, there's a reason why this chaos exists. And the reason is to recognize how much of my adherence to chaos is adherence to fear of myself, fear of my inability to handle it, whatever it was, right? And then by just sitting with that fear and trying to integrate it in some way, like, you know, your shadow, it's the resolution from that is like, I'm not what I thought. Also, I'm not as bad as I thought, you know? And in hand in hand with that assumption in the beginning that I'm like, I'm better than I thought. I'm more peaceful. I'm more like this. And I'm like, nope, actually, that's not the case. Hand in hand with that was like, and you're also not a bad person either, you know? And that was also something that I needed to learn because I think I had kind of held on to this internal sense that if I did let it go, if I did just relinquish it and surrender to the creative flow, that what I would find at the end of it is I was just a shitty person, you know? But I'm not. I'm a good friend. I'm a solid father, husband, whatever, right? And son. But that doesn't mean that I'm without faults, but all these things, of course, but I mean, all these things were only accessible as a result of like it being too much to handle. Mm-hmm. You know, everything was just too much. And as a result of that, it kind of broke it all down. And I'm profoundly grateful for that.
Yeah. I think the moth is extremely multi-layered. I don't want to say there is chaos or it's too much. I want to say it's multi-layered.
I'll say it for you. It's chaos and it's too much.
I think it's a record that we need to take time to listen to it, to hear the details. And what do you think? Does music have to be accessible, or should music should it be just as demanding as great literature or visual arts?
Again, I think it depends on your intention. my intention for this is not to be seen as anything, is not to make art in the eyes of anybody. It's to accurately represent the things that I feel like I've experienced and then try to distill that into something that when you press play, you're like, oh yeah, it makes me feel a certain way. When it came down to the artwork, you'll notice it's just a picture of my face, but there's nothing else in it. It's just black and white, right? And what I started feeling towards the end is it's not important. The moth is not important. None of this work is important. So by trying to portray it as if the complexity or the chaos is an indicator of some sort of, like you're on a mission or you really want people to hear it a certain way, or you know, putting out a press release about the best way to listen to this is you put on headphones, listen in the dark or whatever, or here's the theme and here's the protagonist and here's the antagonist. I just chose at the end to not do that because it's not important for people to listen to. If people find it off-putting when they first start listening to it, there's no desire on my side, at least, to try and convince them to listen to it, like at all. So I would much rather people listen to what they want to listen to, as opposed to the reason why they don't like it is because of something that I need to explain to them. That just means that it's probably not for them. But for me, it was what I needed to do. And when I made that decision, I also made the decision to not try and convince anybody to listen to it, you know?
Yeah. I think it's the point for me, what you said, is to be authentic. You did really authentic work with it. And when I think about great visual arts or some literature, then from years ago, from 100 years ago and so on, then sometimes I think also these people, they do what they think they need to do to express themselves. And I think about it by listening to The Moth.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. I mean, I will have to give huge amounts of credit to the team. But I would say that the decision to say what you want to say, knowing that it's going to be either too much for people or it's going to be confusing to people, or they're going to view you as crazy for doing it, is part of the process, because I have resisted being as creatively free as I've wanted to be at several points in my career because I was afraid that people were going to not understand it. I was afraid people were going to listen to something that is rooted in creative freedom and then make the assumption that it's actually an indicator of like a mental imbalance. You know, the fact that you've done that is not like, I'll do some things that are very abstract. And then if people don't understand it, they're just like, oh, you're crazy. And for years, that was like a real trigger for me because I thought, it's not crazy. I'm just doing whatever I feel like doing. It's just free. No other parts of my life are free. You know, I have no, like most of them, there's no freedom in our life, really. It's like I get to go on vacation once in a while, but, you know, I work huge hours and tour and all this sort of thing. So it's not like there's a lot of like legitimate freedom, but where I can be free is within the work. And to think that in the past I have neglected some of those moments just because I was afraid of what people who I don't even know might assume is really like shooting yourself in the foot for no reason. So again, part of the fight is to say, this is important to me. I'm going to do it. And if your intent behind it is that to help, not to hinder, hopefully, then go for it. And if people think you're fucked up, or if people think you're crazy, or if people think that it sucks or it's too, it's like, it's not your problem, you know, but that decision to make that leap is like a big one. And I think that to anybody who's listening to this, who's also creative, that is afraid of being seen, the only thought that I have in terms of that particular fear is get the failure out of your system as soon as possible. Like, I've got several musician friends that have been working on the same album for upwards of 5 years. And I'm like, why don't you just put it out? And they're like, well, it's not perfect yet. It's not done. And I'm like, you know, if your fear of being seen as imperfect prevents you from putting out work, chances are you'll never put anything out because you're not perfect. You know, none of us are. So I've been very fortunate to have like a bunch of things that I've done fail, like publicly. And by getting that out of the way, I'm not afraid of it anymore. I'm not afraid of being seen. I'm not afraid of failing. And so that's my best advice to anybody listening to this who's a musician that's afraid of being seen because of the potential of failure. Just fail. Just get it out of your system. Because past that is where the good stuff lies, right?
Devin, thank you so much. I think these were perfect closing words. And so I want to thank you for our conversation, for your insights into your work, and for the deep philosophical speech we have.
I mean, it's like, again, that's another thing. I mean, the amount of people are just like, oh, you're pretentious or whatever. I'm just like, dude, I'm just being me. If that's how you feel, it's cool. Yeah. You know, I'm doing my best.
Okay.
Thank you so much for the interview.
What remains is not so much a simple classification as an invitation to engage with music that not only wants to be consumed, but also challenges in size, in its complexity, and in what it can reflect about ourselves. Devin, thank you so much for being my guest today. My name was Diana Heinbucher. This was the Metal.de podcast, Metal Minds, The Pit Unplugged, and stay metal, stay loud. The Pit!